Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. I am joined by author Charlotte Dune, and we discuss a book that she sent my way called Cactus Friends, A Psychedelic Love Story. We talk about what went into writing the book and why she's writing psychedelic fiction and also her career as a diplomat and a lot of different issues. We had a great conversation and I think that you will enjoy it. I will note that we had our conversation last Tuesday, and as I'm sure everybody is aware, on Wednesday, some really crazy shit happened here in the United States of America. And, you know, I'll probably have more to say about this next week. I don't really want to get into too much with the interview here with Charlotte. I don't want to distract from that. Other than to just say that I am personally very disappointed to see how certain factions within the psychedelic movement have completely adopted the QAnon identity. I think it was just really something. You know, the guy who was wearing the horns and was all painted up and the tattoos and screaming and yelling in the Capitol building? He is the self-identified QAnon shaman within the psychedelic movement. And I think it's a really good indication of just how delusional people can be, even within the psychedelic movement, that there's no inoculation to complete and utter BS. And he's a good example of that. And I think that he should be held out as the poor example that he is. So I'm just going to leave that there for right now. If you're interested in my thoughts on what happened on Wednesday, you can visit my Facebook page and you can see the nut job comments that people leave in response. Before we get into our interview with Charlotte, I would like to thank James and Brian for making a monthly contribution in support of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast with a PayPal donation, you can use the PayPal button that is at the top right of my webpage, martinball.net. You can join as a member over at Patreon at patreon.com/martinwball and get all the benefits and support the podcast. It's awesome. Do have a few other interviews lined up. Later this week, I'm going to be interviewing some representatives from a group that is looking to legalize psilocybin and MDMA therapy in Canada. And also looking to get an interview in with an individual who is looking to raise capital for venture capital for psychedelic startups for the changing landscape of access to legal psychedelic therapy and medicine that is rapidly going to be overtaking the world here and there. I think that would be an interesting conversation. Never interviewed anybody about investing money in psychedelics. And so, yeah, I think it should be interesting, and hopefully that'll be coming in the next few weeks. Next week, we'll be continuing with my audiobook for my memoir, Being Infinite, and at that point, I might say a little bit more about just what I think is going on with the Trump cult. And yeah, it is a cult, and you know, if you're a supporter of Trump, you're probably a member of the cult, and might be a little bit of a harsh reality for you. I definitely know that I'm losing friends and losing listeners based on my positions. I am not a member of the Trump cult. I will never be a member of the Trump cult. And I hope that you aren't personally, because if you are, sorry to say, but you are living in a delusional reality. Well, I said I wasn't going to get into it, so I'm not going to get into it, but really enjoyed my conversation with Charlotte. She spoke with me from way over there on the other side, Florida, and we had a good time. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and you can check her out online at charlottedune.com, and you can find her books there, and also she works with people dealing with alcoholism and some great resources, and also helping people be writers and get started in the writing process. So, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Charlotte Dune. Once again, she's the author of Cactus Friends, A Psychedelic Love Story, and it's part of a trilogy of books. The other two are forthcoming shortly. Here she is. Yeah, well, it's great to have you here, Charlotte. So you're the author of what looks like it's either is or is going to be a trilogy. Have the other two books been written yet, or are they still in the works?
The second one has been written and edited, and it's in the like final stage before it gets launched. So basically marketing material is getting put together. So Cactus Friends is available now. The second one's called Mushroom Honeymoon. That one is finished. It's going to be available in February around Valentine's Day. And then the third one in the trilogy, I've written about half of it. So have some more to write for that one.
Okay, so there's still a little bit in the works. But yeah, you had contacted me more towards the beginning of the year, I think, sometime. I'm not quite sure when, but you'd contacted me and mentioned that you had written a book about, a novel about Wachuma and a romance story. And just as I was digging through my emails of requests for interviews or people who, you know, were interested in being on the podcast, that I was digging through and I found yours. I was like, oh, actually, this is perfect, because I just, as I mentioned to you when I reached out, that I just interviewed Sergei Bodanov, who was, he's Ukrainian, who had immigrated to Israel and then ended up in the United States and then ended up in Peru and got into Wachuma, ended up serving Wachuma at a retreat center now in Peru. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be perfect to have someone else come and talk about Wachuma? And so it just seemed like the perfect fit to have you on now. So here we are.
Great. And yeah, it's interesting. When I first, I did my first Wachuma ceremony almost like 3 years ago. And I remember right before the ceremony trying to do more research and like trying to watch things on YouTube or like listen to podcasts about it. And there really wasn't that much stuff.
No.
And now I recently went on again and was looking for the same topic to send a video to someone else. And there's so much more stuff. So I'm glad that it's kind of making the rounds and people are learning about it. And I think the book that I wrote that centers on Wachuma. Sorry, I don't know what. Is that you or me?
I have no idea what that is.
I don't know what just happened. My phone just started. I think Siri must have thought I was talking to it. Ghost in the machine.
Siri, you are not a part of the conversation. Go away, Siri.
That was so strange. What was I saying? Okay, yes. So Cactus Friends, which centers on, it's a novel, but it is inspired kind of by some ceremonies that I did myself. But I decided to put it into novel form because I felt like there wasn't enough fiction around this. I had always loved the Carlos Castaneda books, but when people would ask me for book recommendations about psychedelics or about plant medicine, entheogens, however you want to call it, I was at a loss to recommend anything that I thought was kind of, how should I say this, like more accessible and less scientific, because not everyone wants to read a super sciencey book. You know, some people don't want that. Some people want to read something more fictionalized. And so the book kind of came to me and I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to write some fiction that involves plant medicine because I don't see this around. And this is what I personally want to read myself.
Yeah.
And it's been really well received. I've had book clubs do it. I've had a lot of like small groups of people that are kind of interested in using entheogens. And they've read my books and we've done discussions. And I run a group now specifically for alcoholics who are interested in using entheogens in their recovery. Which is another topic that I'm really interested in and also working on putting together a book on that topic with interviews of alcoholics who have gone through recovery and have incorporated plant medicine into their recovery. That is going to be a nonfiction book. But so, yeah, I just became very interested in all of these topics and working it into fiction and kind of making it accessible for a different audience. So most of my readers are middle-aged women.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, some of them, and some of them are older, some of them are kind of like grown up flower children who are kind of coming back to this in their retirement and are interested in doing ceremonies.
Yeah.
And then some of them are a bit younger and are kind of just fascinated and curious, but maybe not ready to try a ceremony themselves or an experience. I should say experience, because you don't always need to have like a ceremonial kind of thing.
Yeah.
But and they enjoy the fiction. I let you know. And I enjoy doing it. I just released the audiobook version actually of Cactus Friends, and that was a blast to put together. I worked with them, some musicians, make a soundscape and try and really give that like ceremony feel to the sections in the book where they're in a Wachuma ceremony. So yeah.
Yeah. It's funny actually, cause we kind of have a lot of parallels here in that, I like to do my books as audiobooks as well. And, I just finally got the approval on, it was actually my very first book. It's called Orubai's Vision, and it's a form of psychedelic fiction. That's actually where I started as a writer. And then I ended up creating a whole soundtrack for that. But I think a lot of people have been working on audiobooks through coronavirus because, you know, previously I've done like 7 other books through audible.com. And they were all approved within like a few days to a couple weeks. And then this has taken months for the whole thing to go through. So I just got notified last week that Orubai's Vision finally made it through. But yeah, I did a bunch of soundtrack. And I released an album that I called the soundtrack to the audiobook, because I think it's fun to put music into audiobooks and make it more of an immersive experience.
I 100% agree, and I also had that experience with Audible being totally backed up and my audiobook taking forever, so I'm really glad it's out now. I should say I was actually very inspired by your book, and I loved, the audiobook that I listened to of yours, and that was...
I think that was Being Human.
Being Human, thank you. I was like, please refresh my memory, because all I remember is 5-MeO-D DMT. Yeah. So, but I actually listened to it twice and really loved how you put the sounds in and made it into this experience versus just a book, almost like a meditative experience, I would say.
Yeah.
So I was very inspired by that when I was putting together the production of my own book.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
You know, one of the neatest compliments I've gotten about that, the audiobook for Being Human, was not this year, because it didn't happen, but last year I got 2 different emails from 2 different people saying that they spent their entire time at Burning Man with Being Human on auto repeat, and they just walked around listening to the book for the entire week.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's like, wow, you really must be into it. But something, this is why I thought it'd be interesting to talk to you. I mean, among other reasons, there's lots of reasons, but one of the reasons is kind of this divide that you've already touched on between sort of the nonfiction books and then the fiction books, where I have certainly found that a lot of people in the psychedelic community, I mean, have just upfront told me, I don't want to read a novel. I'm never interested in reading a novel. I only want to read nonfiction. And then, you know, there's another demographic that is like, I only want to read novels. I don't ever want to read anything that's nonfiction. And I myself have not been able to find a crossover in that I write both nonfiction and I write novels. And my nonfiction outsells my novels by many orders of magnitude. And so within my own audience, there's no crossover. But I would think that perhaps you as a woman writing for women, and I think that that's actually the largest novel demographic, is women. Women tend to read novels. So that gives you an advantage. And then in writing in the area of fiction, and basically, you know, you're writing romance novels. That's what most women read. Those are kind of the top sellers. So it's kind of a, it's both a really ripe demographic, but it's also one that then hasn't been exposed to a lot of work about entheogens. So it makes it a very interesting area for you to be writing in. So I'm not surprised that then you are getting book clubs and things like that, that it's kind of a breath of fresh air within that area. So what kind of responses have you gotten there, especially from people who have never really maybe learned much about plant medicines or entheogens? Are they saying like, wow, your book really gave me something different? Or
yeah, it's interesting because I think most of the people reading nonfiction books about entheogens have already tried entheogens or are about to try them.
Yeah.
And are maybe like long-time practitioners. Whereas definitely people reading my novel, many have never tried, have never thought about it, have never known this existed. They picked it up because it sounded like an interesting romance adventure story, or they liked the cover, or they heard about it from somebody. I think there's been a lot of word of mouth from my book. And because I'm in recovery communities myself, there's been a lot of like recovery circulation, and I did a bunch of podcasts in the recovery genre talking about it. So I get a lot of those people too, who are kind of like, is this drugs? Is this not drugs? Can I do this and still be sober? And so that's like a whole discussion. But I think it's like a really eye-opening thing for a lot of people. I remember I had one older retired lawyer who reached out and sent me a message. A retired lawyer from Appalachia, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I can't believe what the kids are into these days. He's like, are people doing this all the time? And I was like, yeah, they are. Like, people are doing this. And he was like, I had heard about LSD, you know, back in the day, but I've never heard of any of this. I didn't know people were doing this in like ceremonies. He's like, you know, this is really interesting. And I love having that kind of response from this older generation who maybe were really closed off to any kind of experimentation with plants for whatever, you know, religious or like cultural reasons. And then they find my book interesting from almost like an anthropological perspective.
Yeah.
So I think couching it in this kind of modern day adventure, but trying to insert that like magic that entheogens can actually insert into your own life. Like these, you know, we have these like spiritual experiences, creative experiences, really profound realizations that can sometimes happen when you're experimenting with these plants or compounds, and to put that into fiction, I mean, it actually works really well because it's fantastical, and then you can have these fantasy elements, and it's magical realism. I was looking at like the top, in Amazon, you can look at all this stuff in the back end, and you can see like what people were searching for that then bought your book.
Mm-hmm.
And the number one thing that people search for that they end up buying my book is magical romance. So it's, you know, appealing to people that want these like magical love stories. And then I guess they're liking it because I'm only getting 5-star reviews right now. So I'm really happy about
that. That's awesome. And in a sense, it's kind of the perfect time for it that, you know, while we are dealing with coronavirus and everything else, that, you know, a sense of a magical romance, I'm sure, is appealing to a lot of people right now.
Completely. And I think my second searched term is funny too, which is Florida romance. So I guess there's a genre for that too, because the book is very much set in Florida. You know, it's set on the edge of the Everglades. And I don't know what exactly people are expecting from a Florida romance, but I hope I deliver some of it to them. So yeah, it's been I'm really excited about my next one. My next one actually focuses on Silawaska.
Mm.
So it has the same characters from the first book, the same couple, but they delve into this Silawaska experience that kind of leads them through a journey of inner development. So in addition to the romance, it's really like what they call metaphysical fiction. I kind of try to incorporate some of my own like broader ideas about the universe and synchronicity and spirituality and love and divine kind of inspiration and connection.
Yeah. And I think that novels are just such a great forum for exploring that. I mean, again, I certainly have enjoyed exploring that in novels myself. And even, you know, I tried writing a romance that my fifth novel is Beyond Azara, a universal love story. And so, you know, it's a romance, but it gets into ayahuasca and 5-MeO and religious dogmatism and, you know, trying to break away and find your authentic self and all of that. And so I think it's a great medium and that, you know, I think that psychedelic fiction, you know, really should be its own genre in a sense. And hopefully there will be more authors like you coming out and writing these things. Because I think it's sort of an untapped market and it's a great way to explore it. And so I do want to talk to you more about some of your own personal experiences, but I mean, you've already kind of hinted that your experiences also informed what you've written about. And I would say that I've done the same thing in my novels. I mean, some of the chapters are literally trips I've had that I've just put into the context of another character, and sometimes even combining, you know, different experiences that I've had into one thing, and also dreams and, you know, other events in my life that they've found their way into the novels. So maybe that's a good segue to let's hear a little bit more about your life and your experience and what brought you into working with the medicines and Wachuma and these other ones as well. And you had mentioned in your original email to me that you've also worked as a diplomat. So maybe we could start there.
It's true. okay. So, well, let me just say that I got into all of my experimentation with these visionary plants after I left the State Department, after I stopped working as a diplomat, mm-hmm. Because surely they would not have taken me while I was doing that,
yeah.
Since they have very strict no drug policies and drug tests. But yes, so I really came back to plant medicine or entheogens. I think we'll just use the term entheogens.
Sure.
So that's a good one that covers everything. So when I was around like 28, I had some really traumatic personal experiences while I was working overseas in Cameroon as a diplomat. Mm. And I encountered a lot of violence and was personally attacked and was held at gunpoint, just some really traumatic experiences in Cameroon. And so my next assignment, I was posted in Canada. And while I was in Canada, I realized, you know, I really have PTSD. Like, it became really clear to me that everything that had happened while I was working in Africa, which I had lived in Africa for 9 years, so on different assignments, it became clear to me that all of that had caused me to have PTSD. Mm-hmm. And I was really heavily self-medicating myself with alcohol because, you know, I just needed to get through my life. I had a child, I had a full-time job that was demanding. I was going through a divorce, so there's a lot going on. And I realized, okay, I've got PTSD, I'm abusing alcohol, I need some help. So I started turning to these recovery communities, but I was really nervous because in the State Department, you can lose your medical clearance, you can lose your security clearance, so you can ultimately kind of lose your job if you show that you have like substance abuse issues, or like they try to make it better. They try to say, well, we're going to send you to like rehab and like help you, but ultimately you you get sent back to Washington. You don't really get promotion opportunities because it just doesn't work out. So I was very nervous. So I didn't want to go to in-person stuff. So I started listening to podcasts. And there's a podcast called The Recovery Elevator, which I'll plug. It's great. Like, I don't work for them, but it's a great show. And on that podcast, the fellow on there who's the podcast, he was the podcast host at the time. His name's Paul Churchill. He's also written a great book. He was talking about how, as part of his sobriety, he had gone and done plant medicine ceremonies in Costa Rica. So I was like, oh, I've never heard of this. And having worked in different places, having, been fairly educated, I have a master's degree, I kind of had thought I had heard about everything there was to hear about in the universe kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that feeling where you're like, I'm not going to hear too much stuff that's brand new to me.
Yeah.
But this was all brand new to me. And I was like, how did I not know this whole world of people doing these ceremonies existed? So I got really fascinated by all of that. In the meantime, I was trying to like work on my own sobriety, and I was trying to do kind of like talk therapy for the PTSD. I tried like a yoga therapy thing. So I was trying these different modalities. I'd been put on medication that didn't really work, went off that. And so I started thinking, oh, I really want to do one of these plant medicine ceremonies. And during this time period, my tour in Canada was ending, and they wanted to send me to Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso. That was supposed to be like my next assignment. And I was just like, I can't go back to Africa. Like, that PTSD response was still so strong. I just didn't want to go back to another like sub-Saharan African place that was, and sure enough, right after I was supposed to go there, they bombed a hotel and like all these people died in this hotel bombing. So I was like, you know what? It's time for me to just like leave the Foreign Service. I want to go home. I want to go back to the United States. So moved back to where my family was in Florida. And I was like, I'll figure out what I'm going to do here. And I was talking to my brother and I was like, I'd really like to drink ayahuasca. I think I'm going to go to, like, I finally have left the stage apartment. I could actually do this. I could try it.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I have depression. I have anxiety. I have PTSD. Like, I think I need something to really have a huge mind shift. And I think I'm going to go to Peru. And my brother goes, oh, you don't have to go to Peru. You can just go to Miami. Like, my friends are doing that in Miami all the time. And so I was like, what? And, you know, within a month, I was sitting in a ceremony with a group in Miami. And it's, you know, kind of the rest is history from there. So the Wachuma was actually the first ceremony that I did. And maybe that's why it's extra special to me. And after that.
And did you know much about it before that ceremony?
Not really. I had read a book. I think I had read two books, and one of them was very poetic. Maybe you've read it. It's called Miserable Miracle by Henri Michaux.
No, I haven't heard of it.
A French book. He was a French poet. Well, I think he was Belgian originally, but moved to France. But he was a pretty famous poet. But he also wrote this super intense, crazy book on all of his experimentations with mescaline.
Mm-hmm.
So different. He did Wachuma, he did peyote, he tried different Peruvian torch, he tried like all the Mexican producing cactuses, and he would write about all of his trips, and he would draw pictures of what he had seen in the trips and then write poetry about it. So that's the book that sticks out in my mind. But I really didn't know what to expect. I tried to watch like a few YouTube videos about it. I obviously talked to the people that were organizing the ceremony. I think a lot of ceremony organizers, they don't want to give you too many preconceived notions about what you might experience, which is wise. Like, every person is different. You never know. And the Wachuma ceremony that I went to was pretty special because it was the 10th anniversary that this group had been doing ceremonies in that location. So they had invited like everybody that had done ceremonies with them before. There were like 20 different musicians there, all like performing music throughout the ceremony. They had grown this, they'd actually brought the San Pedro from Ecuador, and they had grown it themselves and like their family's like property. And it was just really special to them that they were sharing it with us. And they had made like a tea out of it. And then they had also made like edible pieces for us to eat and did a very long ceremony, about like a 12-hour ceremony. And then, yeah. And then
it was long.
It was long. And then even after that, like we stayed there and, you know, kind of had like an integration experience. So that really kicked off my path back in. And I don't know, I just saw everything in my life improve after that.
Yeah. I'm just curious, like what was your experience and, you know, what was new for you through that?
Yes. So I think it, you know, people talk about Wachuma as being like more of a heart opening or more of like a emotional experience than necessarily like visuals or, I mean, so for me in that experience, I really felt like I had a time travel experience, and I know that sounds so crazy and people are like, she's nuts.
No, but, it's just entheogens.
Yeah, it's just entheogens, guys. So yeah, very, you know, similar to what I hear some people describe ayahuasca as, they go back to some moment in their past and they relive that moment. I've actually never had that happen with ayahuasca where I relived a moment, but with the San Pedro, I did relive this moment that, still to this, you know, I went back in time to this moment where I had been watching this man, this older man, feed birds and watching all the birds like fly through the trees. And it had happened about almost exactly like 1 year before the San Pedro ceremony, and had just been a very quiet, beautiful moment when I was in a park watching this older man feed the birds. But I'm like there again, watching him, just realizing the, you know, complete temporariness of life and how briefly we're on this planet and these like special moments. So I wouldn't say it was anything like crazy profound, but it just got me back in touch with my joy. Mm-hmm. And like back in touch with my joy for small moments. And that moment lasted so long during the ceremony for me. And I was just weeping. Apparently tears were just like going down my face. My friend was like, you were weeping for so long. I was worried about you. And I was like, they were tears of joy. And I also noticed that my language, my center of language in my brain was connecting in like an unusual way. I kept thinking about like different words, and I remember after the ceremony ended, it was something was still connected in a strange way. And I remember asking for a piece of pineapple, like, oh, I'll have a piece of pineapple. And they were like, it's a watermelon. And then I looked at it and I was like, oh, you're right. But my brain was like, that's a pineapple. And so things were just like, you know, that was me trying to like be sober again when I wasn't ready to be back in like full reality. But I just knew, yeah, like some connections have been switched around during this ceremony.
Did it make you nervous at that moment?
No, because I think I was still in like the bliss of the experience. Oh. I was just like, oh, I'm still in my ceremony. It hasn't ended yet. Well, obviously, I should just sit back down and close my eyes probably.
That's great. Because I asked because that, you know, in the later end of psychedelic work or entheogen work, that, you know, that's where people start to engage again, and that sometimes that's where people might have a major freak out. Like sounds like you went through this sort of a cathartic experience and you were kind of just sort of basking in that glow. But even something as small as that, like if someone's like, oh shit, I just called that a pineapple, it was a watermelon, I'm losing my mind. I'm never coming back, you know, and then they have a major freak out over something so minor, but it sounds like you were able just to, oh no, I'm still in it. I just relax. It's okay.
Yeah. It's like not time to be identifying fruit. Just go close your eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that is maybe reading that Miserable Miracle book. 'Cause in the book, he writes a lot about how like the Watchuma goes in and kind of shifts the connections in your mind, and you need to let it happen because it's like taking apart a telephone and putting it back together when it might be broken, and then you're making like repairs. And I did kind of feel that I really needed a good cleaning out. I was also having some physical health problems, no doubt probably brought on by, you know, this stress of what I had gone through combined with like alcohol abuse. Mm-hmm. And so that San Pedro ceremony too, like really preparing for it and going through it, it really shifted me health-wise as well. So afterwards, I like slowly took care of all the health problems I had, eventually resolved them, and kind of like used it as a pathway into just a better, healthier lifestyle, made like new connections with friends. And now I've sat with that group, you know, many times since then, not always with the San Pedro, but then started doing some ayahuasca ceremonies. So I think, I mean, I highly recommend it to people. I think there's so much value for people that are totally healthy. And I think there's also so much value for people that are struggling with something.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's not for everyone. Like, I'm not a doctor. If you have schizophrenia or you're bipolar, you know, you can't really, I don't know. But I think for me, for having like PTSD, like I feel like it's cured. I don't have it anymore. It's done. Like all that stuff just helps me move on. I also feel like it did wonders for any kind of depression and anxiety that I had that was maybe unrelated. I do think it's something that you need to do maybe like 2 to 4 times a year to maintain like the full health benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I go, I feel like if I go too long without engaging in that kind of, and I don't know if it's the connection or the spiritual experience or all the preparation that I do kind of around the ceremonies, because I'll clean up my diet, I'll I'll focus on like meditating every day before I do the ceremonies for like week, like I really get focused on my health. But I find if I go too long without doing one, like say if I go like 6 or 7 or 8 months without doing it, I start to feel the depression coming back, which is kind of what the scientific studies are showing as well. Like especially the research done on ayahuasca, it seems like there is an ideal amount that you should do, and it is somewhere around like every month to like quarterly. But if you kind of do it less than that, then you'll need a booster shot.
Yeah,
how I think of it. So. Again, I don't know if that's from the plant medicine itself or if it's from the like community of it all and the spiritual. I haven't really experimented with, I know some people will just like drink ayahuasca or eat peyote in their bedroom by themselves. And while I would like to do that, I haven't, like, I'd like to try that for the sake of trying it. I haven't really had the opportunity to do that. I've just had the opportunity to do these more organized ceremonies with the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you'll get the same. I suspect that you would probably get the same benefits from just doing it. I don't know. I guess it probably depends on every person too.
Yeah, that some people seem to do really well in a group setting and having that sense of community, having that sense of connection. And then if it is like heavily ceremonialized, some people really resonate with that, kind of provides them with the structure. Okay, somebody's in charge. And then other people, that can be very hard for them in, you know, in that social situation. And you know, some people use entheogens to help with social anxiety issues. And for them, like being in a group is like, oh, that's no, terrible. But if I can do it on my own. But yeah, this idea that it's something that it's not just once that you revisit it, and that, you know, people get an afterglow, and an afterglow can wear off, and you might kind of suppress some of the patterns of the ego that are, you know, obsessed with the obsession or the depression or the anxiety or whatever it is, and that those can be calmed down, but then they can reassert themselves. And so it is something that it's about work. It's not just about one experience. And just something that seems really interesting to me, and I think is also quite beautiful, that you describe in this first Wachuma experience, how it wasn't some grand cosmic revelation. It's just the appreciation of the beauty of a transient moment in time. And, you know, that's the big key, right? Is it's all now. It's all now, man. So just pay attention to the now, that the moment is all that there is. But just having that catharsis around something as simple as a man feeding birds, you know? And I think that it's nice to kind of emphasize something like that when it shows up, because so much of what gets put out there around psychedelics and entheogens is, you know, about cosmic, mind-blowing stuff and entities and realms and all of that. And sometimes it's just so simple. It's just, wow, this is beautiful, watching a man feed birds in this transient moment of time. So it's nice.
It's true. And I almost, you know, it was so real that after the ceremony, I almost questioned, like, was that actually a moment I experienced, or was that like something I had watched in a movie or something? Because it was such a random moment from time. So I went back in my phone and I actually found like a picture that I had taken in that park. Because, you know, I Instagram stuff, and I was like, no, there it is. And I had actually like videoed the birds and the trees. So I watched it and I was like, yep, that was the moment of all the moments it could have shown me. And it just, I think of it as like a hinge. And people talk about this in recovery too, where like a small hinge can open a door that leads to a big new room.
Yeah.
And so that moment, I think, or like reconnecting in that ceremony, was just like a small hinge that opened a big door for me into this new big room that was happier and more creative and more free and just more experimental and playful space in my life.
Yeah.
So very grateful for that.
And so then, is this the inspiration for the birds and the feathers in the book, or does that come from another inspiration?
Yeah, so I think the bird imagery in the book, you know, was inspired by me thinking about those birds. But like you said, and I need to read that novel you talked about, because I was like, well, that sounds right up my alley. What was it called again?
Beyond Azara.
Beyond Azara.
Yeah.
Just like you mentioned about combining experiences. So I, in Cactus Friends, like the catalyst of the story stems from a moment that happened in another ceremony that I did, which was more of a kind of crazy, cosmic, profound moment. I was in the ceremony experiencing a lot visually. This was during an ayahuasca ceremony. And all of a sudden I saw the name of this person on a tree. Mm-hmm. And so in the story, the main character in the novel is a girl named Thelma, who's a photographer, and she's like really dissatisfied with her life, feeling like it's quite meaningless, and she wants to make art instead of doing like commercial portraits and stuff. So she goes to the ceremony kind of trying to find herself again, like reclaim her creativity or like figure out the direction of her life. And she also sees a name on the tree, and like unraveling the mystery of that name leads to the rest of the story. But for me, when I saw the name on the tree, it was from a friend. It was the name of a friend that I hadn't seen in about like 6 or 7 years, because it had been someone that I had known when I lived in Uganda, and I had moved away, and so I hadn't seen them. They hadn't traveled to the U.S. I hadn't traveled back to Uganda, and so I was just like, "Why did I?" And I saw it like the whole ceremony. It was just like right there. And so at the end of it, I was like, why did I just see that name written in the tree? And God's so like, what are you trying to tell me? And so, you know, I got home, I recovered from the ceremony. And then maybe like 2 or 3 days later, I messaged the person whose name I had seen. And he said, oh my God, I'm so glad you messaged me because I was thinking about you. Because I got into a terrible car accident and I almost died a few days ago and I'm still in the hospital. And I was just like, holy crap. And he was like, for whatever reason, you were just like on my mind. And I was actually like thinking about calling you, but I didn't have your number and da 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 da. And so, you know, this plant medicine had just like reconnected us at this really traumatic time in his life, where he had almost died. And of course that was like right when I was in that ceremony basically, which was just insane. I mean, I went back cause I was like, did I see someone else talking about him being in the experience? Like I was trying to just rationalize it for myself, but nope. I think it was one of those, call it synchronicity or call it something else.
Yeah. It's the psychedelic version of when the phone rings and you just know who it is on the other end, even though they haven't called in years, you know, I mean, that's an experience that I'm sure many people can relate to. And this is just kind of an amplified version of that. And I'm curious, so that this person's name, it was written in English, I presume.
Yeah.
Cause that is just kind of an interesting phenomenon of when people see language versus not seeing language, or because, you know, lots of people claim to see like alien languages or Sanskrit or Hebrew. You don't hear people saying that they saw English very much. Like one time I don't even remember what I was on now. It was a mix. I think it was a mix of things. And I saw a bunch of script that I assumed at the time to be Arabic. I don't read Arabic, so I couldn't tell you specifically if it was Arabic. And then there's been other times on MDMA where I've seen very clear English, just crystal clear English. But it doesn't show up very often. It just makes me remember one quick story that I wanted to share with you, because it's about seeing something written. I was speaking to this woman who had an Ibogaine journey. And she said that for the full duration of the whole thing, nothing happened. Just nothing happened, nothing happened, nothing happened. You know, and Ibogaine lasts for hours and hours. And he said that just nothing happened. And I think I remember this correctly. I could be slightly wrong. But she said that at the very end, she was at a retreat center. She went outside, sat on the beach, looked up in the sky. And then a banner unfurled in the sky. And it just said, have more fun.
I love it. I mean, sometimes we need some really direct messages.
Yeah.
But you know, now that I think of it, now that you say that, I cannot remember another time when I've seen any word written, you know, any scripted language at all. But yeah, it was actually written in like big gold letters, which sounds so cheesy, but just like on a tree. So yeah. When I feel like those experiences kind of usher in that amplified, like you were saying, it's knowing who's calling on the phone, but amplified.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, once you're in that groove where the afterglow of your experiences is kind of lasting and you've really gotten yourself in this mind frame where you're like focused on it, then that amplifies all these areas of synchronicity in your life.
Yeah.
And kind of all these things start happening in a way that feels really like destiny is happening all the time, or like you're having some kind of more magical experience than normal. And I guess some people, you know, scientifically, people would be like, oh, it's just experiencing like delusion or like feelings of grandeur. And you're like, no, it's not really what this feels like. Like it just, you're just more in tune with yourself, I think. And then when you're more in tune with yourself, you're more receptive to stuff that's going around on around you, or you notice it more. I don't know if you have thoughts on
Yeah,
you've experienced what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, I remember one time some guy sent me an email and he's asking, like, well, do you experience synchronicities? And I wrote him back and I said, well, I just kind of call that reality. And he's like, oh, well, I experience synchronicities all the time, so I'm so much more enlightened than you. And it's like, oh, okay, thanks for sending me the email. But it's kind of this idea, like you're saying, that look, when we kind of relax and just pay attention, that actually this it's just happening all the time. And I do think that some people can take that into the realm of delusion when they start, if people start using that to then excuse their behavior or give up responsibility for their behavior, where they say, oh, well, no, I have to do this because I saw this sign. So that means I have to do it, rather than I'm choosing to do it. That, you know, it can push some people into, I think, kind of delusional behavior. But I think it's a normal part of the process.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's like, I was called to do that.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Then kind of moving forward in my kind of experimentation phase, I think it was right after reading your book, the Being Human book, that once again, that's kind of fell into my lap that somebody offered me Bufo. Mm-hmm. So then after that, I did a Bufo ceremony. And that really kind of, that one, I feel like the afterglow lasts so long. And you're kind of in that really relaxed, receptive state for a long time. So I also recommend that one to people that are in recovery. I feel like it's gotten some bad press. Like if you try to watch videos of Bufo ceremonies, people might get scared.
Yeah.
But I think it's very good. I think there's something very good and healthy for your mind about in taking the doing a Bufo ceremony. Yeah. So that's another one that I try to share with people that are struggling or maybe looking for some clarity on things, because it is a short experience, you know, and it's doesn't require as much like physical preparation as something like ayahuasca. So I think for some people that are looking for recovery, even though people think it's very extreme, it's actually kind of a easier gateway, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's a shame that it's has like a bad reputation, because I think it can be really beneficial too, and saw a lot of positive benefits from that. So yeah, so now I'm really I'm very, very much focused on helping other alcoholics and other people in recovery to kind of strengthen their recovery through these practices, while being very careful to make sure that it doesn't like flow into a different realm of escapism or, you know, like substance abuse. Because I do think like people say, oh, psychedelics don't have like the potential for substance abuse. And I don't think that's true. Like I think any addict can find a way to abuse substances. So that is also like a line that I think is important to explore. And
yeah, because it's not necessarily a physical addiction, but certainly as a form of escapism, or for some people, it can engender a displeasure with normal reality. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, oh, I want to get back into that magical place, and I got to do it every weekend or something like that.
Yeah, and I see it more with mushrooms, maybe because they're just so much more accessible, and they're kind of like shorter lasting, like they're, you know, they're just, you can do them in a way that it's not so intense, but it's pleasurable. So I also think that's something to be avoided. If that's what you want to do, but it's not helpful in a recovery sense, mm-hmm. I guess is what I'm saying. So I'm hoping to actually, before COVID hit, I was working with a group and we were hoping to do some in-person retreats with the plant medicine specifically for alcoholics. So specifically for people looking for help with their sobriety from alcohol. and that we've had to postpone, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to do it in the summer, this summer. We'll just see how COVID goes.
Yeah. And in terms of Florida, I mean, it is kind of an interesting situation that I know that there is, I think there's like the Church of the Sun or something like that. Anyway, I know that yes. There are people serving medicines in Florida. They haven't had legal challenges around it. So it's somewhat of an interesting situation. Do you feel that the state authorities are just kind of taking a hands-off approach or?
So I think it's really great actually. And I'm so glad that you brought it up. So we have the Daime here, the Brazilian tradition of the ayahuasca, which is a religious group. And when I say here, I mean in different places in Florida, because it's not just Orlando. It's like Orlando, Tampa, Miami, you know, these different places. And then there's also SoulQuest, which I think is the one you're referring to.
Yeah.
So SoulQuest Church of Ayahuasca, which is in Orlando. And they have resumed, like they're back to doing ayahuasca ceremonies. And they're in Orlando and they're great. And I think that it's a great place to go and do ayahuasca if that's what's accessible to you. Because going to Peru is not really accessible for everyone, or like going to Costa Rica is not accessible. So if Florida is accessible to you, then I say go. Like SoulQuest, I think, is great. I think the authorities in Florida have realized that this is a very cultural thing. And this is a religious thing for a lot of people. And there's a lot of, I mean, just in Florida, there's a lot of Brazilians here. There's a lot of people from Chile. There's a lot of people from Peru. There's a lot of people from Ecuador. There's a lot of people from Colombia. And so if you start saying, oh, no, you can't do that tradition, it's going to lead to lawsuits. And I think people are just like, you know what, as long as nobody's dying, it's fine. Or as long as a lot of people aren't getting ripped off or scammed, like, we're going to look the other way. And so far I've never heard of anybody getting, I have not heard of any nefarious activity myself personally that's related to this in Florida. Like, I think people are very conscientious here. They try to be really respectful of traditions. And most of the time it's people that have practiced this for many, 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 many years and are from the countries where ayahuasca originates. And they're bringing it here. So the SoulQuest one's interesting too, because they actually filed paperwork, with the FBI, I believe, to lay out exactly what they were doing. So they basically like sent them a legal letter being like, this is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Just want to let you know, like, we're not hiding anything. We're telling you. And they just didn't get a response. So I think they're good. Somebody did have seizures there and I believe did pass away several years ago. But as it is oftentimes in these situations, the person had not been honest about the medication that they were on or about their health risks. So they lied to the practitioners. And because that happened, they weren't able to like get the, you know, they shouldn't have been there in the first place kind of situation. And they did do an investigation on that church and found that they weren't liable and that they had like taken all the proper care and that it was just an unfortunate thing that happened. So I do think, you know, there's also the ayahuasca church in Kentucky, which I'm sure you maybe have heard about as well.
Yeah,
so that one I think is operating in like the same like religious gray zone.
Yeah,
as the one in Florida.
And you know, here in Ashland, we also have the Santo Daime, and I was attending the Santo Daime back in 2008 and 2009, and that's when they brought their court case against the federal government under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and they ended up winning. But one of the odd parts of the court case was that in court, the Daimistas were not permitted to say that there were other ayahuasca churches inside the United States outside of Oregon. so that the legal decision, yeah. even though it was a federal decision recognizing their right to use ayahuasca, it only applies to the state of Oregon. And so they had to create sort of this legal fiction that there were not any other Santo Daime churches anywhere else in the United States.
Which is so not true.
Yeah.
And now they've, I mean, now it's legal in a lot of places in Canada as well.
Yeah.
So all the major cities in Canada. And I guess I should say congrats to Oregon, because you guys just went and decriminalized everyone, everything, and showed like the rest of us how it's done. So,
we decriminalized all drugs, and we also passed Proposition 109 to make psilocybin therapy official and legal in the state.
Which I think is so great and very needed, and I hope all the states follow suit. I mean, Florida has not even recreationally legalized marijuana, which is insane to me. I just like don't understand. But it is decriminalized here, but you can't like run commercial operations, unless it's for medical. So I, you know, part of me is like, oh, let's legalize everything. And then another part of me is like, well, everything's pretty accessible here. Maybe we don't want the Florida government regulating or taxing things. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just fine the way it is. But I do worry about, I do worry about some of the people running these ceremonies that they don't have enough legal protection, or that they could get arrested for, you know, trafficking illegal substances. So it does give me concern. And of course, I think all this stuff should be more accessible. I mean, I can't imagine, like in Oregon, is it like people can go to the store and buy some of this stuff, or no, it's just decriminalized?
Yeah, it's just decriminalized. You know, there are cannabis shops like everywhere, all over the place.
But you can't buy like DMT in the cannabis shop, or can you?
No. So it doesn't open the door for any kind of selling or purchasing. It just means that if you get caught with something, that you just get a fine, and you know, it doesn't go on your record. And then with the psilocybin, what we're doing now is it's starting a 2-year development period about what exactly the program is going to be and how psilocybin is going to be distributed and how to set up a center and all of that. So that's still in the development stage. We're going to see what happens there. In terms of, I don't think we're going to be able to like walk into a store and buy psilocybin, that you're going to have to go to a center and then they have it there. But, you know, it's a development period, so we'll see how that actually works out.
It'd be like a ketamine kind of model.
Yeah, similar to the ketamine clinics, where you go to the clinic, you get your medicine there. Then when you've come down, then you get to go home, but you don't take it home with you.
Yeah, which is, ketamine clinics are legal here, so I'm like, let it all be available. So we'll see. I guess time will tell when they get around to doing that. I would love to see people kind of, I mean, I've read some books on, you know, conducting those kind of experiences for people and being more of like a trip sitter type guide and facilitator, and like psychedelic facilitator, but that's definitely an area that I would love to see more research done on, especially again in the world of addiction and recovery. And Ibogaine too. I mean, it seems like it would be so helpful to the entire United States to be able to have Ibogaine clinics. Like the results have been so positive for especially opioid recovery and heroin recovery. It's like, it's hurting people not to have this stuff available to them. And it's, you know, it would be great if we can open those doors.
So. Yeah. Rather than having to go to Mexico or go to Canada or go to Costa Rica, that not everybody is able to travel. And so if we could have these facilities in our local communities, it's just going to serve more people. It's just going to help more people.
Completely agree. And, you know, like rehab and AA, they don't have the best success rates.
No.
Like the success rates are really low. So there's zero incentive not to try something else. Like there's every reason to try other things, to try and work on these issues. So,
yeah. So on your website, I mean, you have like a community section and you have a lot of information there about, particularly with alcohol abuse. And so like, tell us about the community that you're looking on to
well,
build
the,
there.
And the, so I do have a community, but it's been, I've kept it secret. And so it's just actually like a secret group. I don't have a link to it or on my website. Well, no, I tell people like, just email me, like my email's on the website, or send me a Facebook message or an Instagram message and just let me know, hey, I'm interested in using entheogens for recovery. Because we do share like where these ceremonies are going to be and like ceremonies that people can attend, mm-hmm. and, you know, people can see other people and talk to other people in the group. So for that reason, because it's not legal everywhere, I've kept the group like fairly under wraps.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I call it Entheogens for Alcoholics. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're interested in that, just message me at Charlotte Dune on Facebook, or Charlotte Dune on Instagram, or charlotte@charlottedune.com is the email to use for that. So just let me know. And yeah, we probably could have already started doing in-person stuff, but we do some Zoom stuff. And I've just, some of the people are in Canada and I'm like, I really want to wait till the borders open and people can travel and really feel like comfortable and safe. Like I feel like the last thing that you want during a plant medicine ceremony is to worry about breathing in someone else's air.
Yeah.
Like I just rather COVID be totally over. Like I know people in California are still doing ceremonies. I know people in Costa Rica are doing ceremonies, but until I have like access to tests or some way to hope that everybody is feels safe, I'm like, I don't want people to worry about that, even if it would just be a minor worry, because you're letting out body fluids, people are throwing up, like you don't want to be worrying about COVID while you're in an ayahuasca trip.
yeah just start just obsessing over, oh my goodness, am I breathing the wrong particles in this moment, or you know, psychosomatically convincing yourself that, oh, it's happening now. You know, when people are in those open suggestive states, that it be something that people could have a genuine freak out over.
Yeah, I agree. And then also someone, you know, I was talking to I don't want to call him a shaman, but he's a plant medicine facilitator in Mexico. He's a friend of mine. And he was just telling me, you know, now is really not the time to be doing ceremonies in the United States because people aren't flying back and forth. So all the ayahuasca is coming from the internet via mail instead of people actually bringing it.
Right.
And he's like, he's like, I've heard so many stories this year about people ordering stuff on the internet and it's not what it's, they take it and it doesn't feel like ayahuasca, or it doesn't taste like ayahuasca, or they think it's like stuff that people are adding LSD to, and just some really crazy stories. So I think that's another thing. I don't want to say that that's common. I don't want to freak people out, but I think it's just a reminder that you should really know who you're doing this stuff with and like be confident about where stuff's coming from and find somebody that has good reviews or has good like word of mouth from people you know, and to be careful. And I don't necessarily like recommend just ordering that stuff on the internet and trying to like consume it in your house. So
yeah.
I was like, I can get behind just waiting until COVID's over.
Yeah. Which is just another argument for why it's just more beneficial to have all of this stuff be above board. So that we know where it's coming from. We know the quality, you know, versus the more things are underground, then the more likely you are to get something that's weird or, you know, made in the wrong way or shady characters, you know, that prohibition just creates a criminal underground. I mean, it's basic physics.
It's true. And it's especially even with the Bufo too, you know, it's also like a scarce resource. So
yeah,
it's, you know, it would be better to kind of also like legalize it so we can do research and find like humane ways to collect it, or like see if we can like somehow like really synthesize the total thing. I know they're synthesizing it, but it doesn't have all the exact like compounds that the frogs produce. So I'm like, just the research from a research, from a safety, all these different reasons, it would just be much better to, as I'm sure you know, I'm like preaching to the choir.
Yeah. Well, Charlotte, it's been really great having you on the show today. Anything you feel that we haven't covered that you want to mention? And again, your website is charlottedune.com. I guess actually we haven't talked about the creative cocoon, so maybe we could finish up with that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the creative cocoon is another group that I do. It's mostly a Facebook group, but then I also run challenges with it, and I do those challenges online and like with a combination of Zoom and an app called Marco Polo. And it's really kind of like my own spin on the artist's way. So it's really about like creativity building, and I incorporate like some recovery methodology from like the substance abuse recovery, but applied to like creative recovery. Cause I think so many people, especially in America, where like our lives are so busy and we may have like so many career pressures or just sources of frustration, especially in a year like COVID this year, like 2020. It's a way to like recover the creativity within yourself. So I do activities around building your own creative practices. I've done like recovery writing, 30-day like recovery writing things. I've done in-person things where focused on like a lot of journaling, because I think journaling is like another passion that I have that I think can benefit everyone. So that group is really about creative recovery. So I have the, and I also sometimes recommend entheogens to people in that group, obviously, because I think that can help you recover your creativity. But that looks at, that group in particular is really heavily writing focused, and kind of, I think of writing as an entheogen too, because writing can connect you to like your spirituality. Writing can connect you to ideas beyond yourself, like these kind of impulses or like the muse that kind of comes from the universe.
Yeah.
So it's focused on like meditative writing and building these creative practices. And I've worked with a yoga teacher who does like recovery yoga and like trauma recovery yoga, and paired like writing and yoga together. Worked with like a pranayama breathwork teacher to incorporate like breathwork into your writing practice, and yeah, just ways to build recovery. And can also find out about that on my website, and it's free. Like I just have it free. Sometimes I charge for the like 30-day things I do. But that one is mostly, I just do that stuff as like a free thing, unless people want one-on-ones. But it's just a way for me to connect with my readers and also to like share my creative passions. So you can email me about that too if you want to join.
All right. Awesome. Well, Charlotte Dunn, author of Cactus Friends, A Psychedelic Love Story, and I believe coming soon is Mushroom Honeymoon. And then coming a little bit after that is Hawaii Ayahuasca.
Yes.
Book 3 in the Psychedelic Love series.
Yes. So Mushroom Honeymoon will be out in February. And Cactus Friends in audio and in print and an ebook is already available. And you can find it all on my website, charlottedune.com.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Charlotte. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, too. It was great to talk to you, and I can't wait to read the novels that of yours that I have not read.
Cool. Well, let me know what you think if you do.
Yes. Thanks so much.
All right.